You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Welcome. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
For rider safety, onboard MetroLink trains.
Here at Union Station in downtown Los Angeles, officials are celebrating a momentous occasion for MetroLink. That's the commuter rail system that connects passengers from Ventura, Lancaster, Oceanside, San Bernardino, and everywhere in between. Here's their CEO, Darren Kettle.
And the reason that we're here today is the fact that we're the first railroad in the world to power these locomotives that you see here in our entire fleet with 100% renewable diesel fuel or renewable fuel.
Renewable fuel. That definitely sounds better than gas or coal. But some passengers say renewable fuel doesn't go far enough in the never-ending quest to curb carbon emissions. KCRW's Kaylee Wells has run some of the numbers, and she's here to tell us what she found. Hi, Kaylee.
Hey, Steve.
Well, first of all, can we talk about what renewable fuel is? I mean, I'm picturing those folks in the 2000s who started pouring used cooking oil into there. Can you remember that when they converted the used cooking oil?
And actually, you're not that far off. It's any fuel source that we can replenish. So fossil fuels like natural gas and coal that took eons to make, those are not renewable. But vegetable oil, ethanol, solar, wind energy, biofuels like methane, all of those that we can make without having to wait generations to harvest them, those are renewable.
Okay, I get that. So which of these fuels are the trains using?
So these trains are running on recycled natural oils. So your idea of putting vegetable oil in your car is pretty darn close to what they're doing.
I had a friend.
You had a friend that did that?
I did.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. MetroLink board chairman Ari Najarian actually explained to me what that means.
Well, when you say it's recycled, it was previously used. So it was being used mainly in cooking and food processing. So that is the, you know, that is animal oils, animal fats, and vegetable oils. And that's what's collected with a little bit of refinement, and then it's used in our engines.
So right now, that fuel is actually getting shipped here from Singapore and Finland, which, you know, they didn't exactly advertise the carbon emissions of shipping that here. But the U.S. is working on a processing plant actually here in California, and MetroLink officials say they hope to get their fuel locally from that plant starting next year.
All right, that's great. So apart from these shipping emissions, as you mentioned, all of MetroLink's trains are now running 100% sustainably?
Well, okay, we got to do a quick vocab lesson. So renewable energy does not equal sustainable energy. So, for example, burning wood is renewable energy because we can plant trees that will mature in a lifetime, but it's not sustainable because it emits smoke and carbon that future generations have to breathe. These trains are definitely better. There's 30% less particulate matter, so there's better air quality, and up to 80% fewer carbon emissions, but you're still burning oil. It's not like it's powered by the wind or the sun, so it's not sustainable because it's not a permanent fix. Some train rider advocates say renewable isn't good enough. Paul Dyson is actually one of them. He used to work in the railroad industry, and now he's president emeritus of the Rail Passenger Association of California, which is actually a nonprofit of volunteers who basically advocate for people who ride trains.
I just think it's a little bit naughty calling it renewable. It's really more recycled or reprocessed. What concerns us is that this publicity about this fuel is part of MetroLink's policy to continue with diesel locomotives. And we feel after 30 plus years in operation, it's time for MetroLink to move on and to start using some better technology on a path to electrification and 100% real renewables.
He says naughty.
He says naughty.
He says naughty. So why not just go straight for electric trains, like he says? I mean, we know those work elsewhere. Why not here?
Well, and that's what he said. And MetroLink says they are going to try and do that or something carbon neutral eventually. Their argument is that this renewable energy is a good next step. Here's how Congressmember Jimmy Gomez put it at that press conference.
Sometimes you will hear complaints that, oh, it's not electric or it's not X or it's not Y. But you know what? Progress is cumulative. It builds on the next advancement, the next stop. And I know that this stop is not the last, but just the next one in a cleaner, more equitable future for everyone.
They also just bought all these new, more efficient diesel-burning locomotive engines. And the next clean technology, whether it's hydrogen or electrifying the whole thing, will take a while to implement. And putting a new fuel right into an already existing, pretty brand new engine was a pretty easy switch.
Kaylee Wells, can we take a second here and talk more about the future of public transportation in general? I mean, because especially after the pandemic, it just doesn't seem like a lot of people are using mass transit. We've talked about it on this program before, no matter how green it is.
You're right. That's a point, actually, that the passengers and Metrolink have both made. The best way for the trains to reduce their carbon footprint is to make each ton of carbon that the train does release count with a full train of people. The LA area has the third biggest commuter rail system after New York and Chicago by miles of track, but not the third highest ridership. When you talk about the average number of people per mile of track, and we'll talk about before the pandemic, because obviously that turned everything upside down. Chicago had 460 people per mile. New York had 560 per mile. We didn't even have 100 people. And Metrolink says they're at about 30% of even that pre-pandemic number on their weekday ridership.
So then, Kaylee, how are they supposed to get people to ride the train, right? That's what they have to do.
They get more trains. That's that's what Dyson says. Let's hear from him again.
Any kind of train, whether it's even an old dirty diesel train with 400 or 500 people on board, is going to be better than a lot of people driving single automobiles. That's a given. And one of the things that we've been pointing out to Metrolink for a long time is that for almost the whole of the 30 years of their existence, they focused on commuter pattern type of service to and from downtown Los Angeles. In other words, taking people into town in the morning, taking them home in the afternoon. That is 1950s thinking. Metrolink has got to transition itself into an all-day, seven-day-a-week regional carrier that you can get somewhere from early in the morning to late at night and back again.
So there you have it. You want more people, you get more trains. A lot of these routes also only run a couple times per day, and so a lot of them don't connect. If you want to get from San Bernardino to Lancaster and you got to go through Union Station, you can't just hop from one to another. Metrolink board chair Najarian agrees that that is a problem.
We're hoping to get half-hour service between each and every one of our stations. That in itself is going to draw a huge number of commuters to our system. That is the best way to reduce emissions, is to have more people, more and more, riding the trains.
All of these steps are great in the meantime, but they're only going to be temporary because Metrolink has about 2 decades to figure out something new to reach California's goal of being carbon neutral by 2045. And one option that they're exploring, the first ever hydrogen fuel cell powered train in the country, will start operating on the San Bernardino line in 2024. And depending on how that hydrogen is produced, that would be carbon free.
All right. KCRW's Kaylee Wells reporting for us. Kaylee, nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. From language to culture to identity, immigrants can leave behind a lot of their heritage and instead assimilate once they have moved to be accepted into American society. For some, crossing the Mexico-U.S. border, they may leave Spanish behind completely, trying to be accentless. That was the case for Julissa Nathaly Arce Raya. She immigrated from Mexico and left her language behind. Well, now the L.A.-based author argues that assimilation is not the key to belonging. It's all in her book called You Sound Like a White Girl, The Case for Rejecting Assimilation. And Julissa's with us right now. Hi, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
The title for your book immediately grabs my attention. I mean, what does it mean to sound like a white girl?
Yeah, well, I think that's the argument that I make in the book, that I don't really even know what it means to sound like a white girl. And yet that is something that was asked of me. I was asked to speak English in a certain way. And although it wasn't said, the way that I was expected to speak English was to as closely as possible resemble a white person speaking English, because that's what we view as native speakers. And somebody did tell me that I sounded like a white girl when I was in high school. And though he didn't mean it as a compliment, I took it as one. And later on, people in my own community would tell me I sounded like a white girl to separate me from them, to say I'm not Mexican enough, I'm not Latina enough. So this phrase, you sound like a white girl, to me really encapsulates the double-edged sword that assimilation is for many immigrants and for many Latinos.
When the guy says to you, you sound like a white girl, he wasn't meaning it as a compliment. What was he meaning it as?
He was meaning it as I was stuck up, as I was conceited, as I was not down, I suppose.
Was he Latino?
He was not Latino. He was Black. And I think that's how he meant it. He meant it as you're trying to be something you're not. And in that moment, as I said, I took it as a compliment. I was like, awesome. I sound like a white girl because I had tried for so long to get rid of my accent. I would stand in front of a mirror and try to enunciate my words to imitate the white girls in my school and the all-American girls that were portrayed in every television show and in every movie I ever watched.
I was hoping you would read a portion of your book in one part of the, I guess this is the first chapter, right? Would you mind reading it? It starts with, "We become vicious to our own bodies."
Yes. "We become vicious to our own bodies, to our own souls. In our home countries, we learn to view white as superior, as something we should aspire to. Then, when we immigrate to the United States, we bring those sentiments packed in our own suitcases. Those ideas are heartened on our hearts like a wax seal the moment we cross into the United States. Mexico introduced me to the lie of whiteness. But it was the United States that taught me how corrosive white supremacy truly is. Seeking whiteness is a matter of survival here. White skin in the United States means you exist. It means you matter."
That's really powerful. Can you expand on that idea of how the U.S. taught you just how corrosive white supremacy? I mean, what does that mean? How did you learn that?
Well, I learned it in a few different ways. One was the realization that whiteness is something that is dangled in front of people of color to say, if you aspire to this, if you embody this, then you'll belong in the United States. And the stories that I share in that chapter before I get to this part is, you know, that in Mexico, I learned that whiteness was important, that having lighter skin was more beautiful. But then when I came to the United States, here, being a brown person rendered me invisible. Also because of the way in which we talk about race in America and the sort of very black and white binary. And so I didn't find myself in these conversations. And whiteness is corrosive. It is something that makes us leave behind parts of who we really are for, you know, the promise that we'll belong if we aspire to whiteness. But what I discovered in my own life, and also historically, because there's a lot of history in the book, is that that's never actually worked out for us. Every time we have sought whiteness as a form of protection, as a form to belong, it has not actually yielded the results that we hope.
What do you say to white people who are listening to this right now, who are probably like, well, maybe that's not my collection of all of this. Maybe it's a little, I mean, obviously you're looking through it if you're a white person through a different lens. I mean, what do you say though? Because if the end result is we're all people, we're all the same, we all bleed red, all of those things, how do you reach out and say it's nothing against you?
Yeah. So a couple of things to say to that. One is I did not write this book to reach out to white people. I am pretty clear in the book that this book is for us. And I hope that, you know, white people will pick it up and that they will learn something and that they will learn history that they've never learned before. But this is not a book to reach across the aisle, if you will, because I think that in my own experience with my previous books, I did, I think, write in a way that I was trying to get white people to see my humanity, right? To see that we are, at the end of the day, all humans and we bleed red, right? And I think that I lost a little bit of dignity when I was doing that, because why should I have to convince someone else that I am human just like them? Now, I am also very clear in the book that whiteness and white people are not the same thing. Whiteness is a concept, it's a construct. And people who are not white can also perpetuate white supremacy, can also inflict harm on each other. And that's the paragraph that I read earlier, right? That we become vicious to our own bodies, to each other. So this isn't an anti-white book. There are some hard truths that I think white people reading the book will find uncomfortable, just like there are some uncomfortable things that people of color will read in the book, that Latinos will read in the book of our own community. But this book, it's for us.
This idea of how people sound, right, and the language that we use and how things are pronounced. And I want to go back to that, because you cite an example in your book of a pretty well-known comedian who went on the Ellen DeGeneres show. And how he pronounces his name came up. And here's how it went down.
It's so nice to meet you. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm a huge fan of you.
Thank you. And it's Hasan Minhaj. Yes.
No.
Really?
Well, my name is Hasan Minhaj.
Oh.
I want to do this. I actually want to do this on national television.
Good, please. Because everyone that says your name says Hasan Minhaj.
Yeah, but the real way you pronounce it, and this is a big deal because my parents are here, it's Hasan Minhaj. And people always mispronounce it. They're always like, Hasan Minhaj, Hussein. I'm so sorry, I can't pronounce it. Meet my son, Higsby Witherthrottle III.
And
I'm like...
and you know, you cite that as an example. Why? I mean, because it's like, is it the Americanization of, I mean, this man who obviously is whose parents are not from here, right?
Yeah. So the You Sound Like a White Girl is divided into parts. One, the first part is about dismantling the lies that assimilation leads to belonging. And the second part of the book, it's about reclaiming, you know, a lot of the things that we lose when we assimilate. And one of those things that I talk about reclaiming is our names. You said my name at the beginning, Julissa Natsali Arce Raya. For a long time, I only went by Julissa. I went by Jules. I went by Jay because people couldn't pronounce my name. My middle name, Natsali, means what I most love in Nahuatl. And I gave up that gift that my parents gave me because people couldn't pronounce it. And here was this really famous person reclaiming his name in what he says, you know, the most American show ever. And he's going to go on national television and make her hit, as he says, all the syllables. And that was important to him. And I felt so proud of him, almost like I knew him, because in that reclaiming of his own name, I think a lot of young brown people felt they had the permission to reclaim their own names. And I was nervous when I was hearing him say this. And it was also just like so awkward how he's telling Ellen, my name is Hasan Minhaj. And she's still saying, no, really? Like, that's not how you really say your name. And so to me, that's like a perfect example of what I'm talking about in the book, which is that, you know, if we can learn to say very difficult names that are difficult for our tongues to pronounce, then we can also, you know, get other people to say our names and not change them just to make other people comfortable. Because I think that's so much of what assimilation does. It drives us to care more about the comfort of other people than it does caring about our own heritage, our own culture, the things that truly give us power and makes us beautiful.
You also cite the movie La Familia, which was the 1990s LA, you know, classic. And Guillermo, who is the pride of the family, right, goes to law school, becomes a lawyer. He changes his name to William, to Bill.
Yeah. He starts going by Memo. And I give that as an example. I talk about that movie as an example of, you know, the things that we give up in order to pursue success, in order to pursue these corporate careers that we think, or let me put another way, when I was pursuing my own career on Wall Street.
Yeah, this is your story.
I worked on Wall Street for 10 years before I became a writer. I felt like there was all these things I had to give up about myself in order to find success in this culture, in this environment. And in Memo, I saw the false choices that I had to make in order to be successful in a corporate environment. And now I look back on it and I think, wow, like I wish that there had been a way for me to view success as possible within my own culture, within my own environment, instead of feeling like I had to give up all these things about myself. You know, I say in the book that I don't know who made up these rules that pearls are professional and like big hoop earrings and bright red lipstick are not. And I think so many of those rules are antiquated and we have to change them. And people, you know, all of these efforts about diversity and inclusion, I think that they fall short unless people can truly bring their entire selves into this work environments, because otherwise the onus is always on us and not on the employers and not on these systems. And the systems, I think, is what has to change.
You were on Wall Street in New York. Now you're in L.A. How have you, in the years since, you said you had to choose sort of between success and culture. Mm. Obviously, you chose your culture, and this is who you are, right? The real you. How has that been going in L.A.?
I love Los Angeles so much. I have been here for 7 years, and in those 7 years, I have become the best, most authentic version of myself because it is here, it is in Los Angeles, in the presence of other Latinos, that I have let go of my assimilated self. And I have learned that it is actually my culture that is driving my success. You know, that I don't need to look for approval. I don't need to turn to the white gaze to feel successful or to feel accepted. And in many ways, you know, I grew up in Texas. I lived in New York for 10 years, and now I live in Los Angeles. And my Latina experience in each of those three places has been so different and has been, you know, informed by the people around me, by the culture around me. But I very much feel like I had to come to Los Angeles to finally be the person that I was meant to be.
What do you say to people who come up to you and say, well, this is America. You are supposed to assimilate. This is a melting pot. I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. If assimilation truly gave us belonging, then I might have written a different book and I might be talking about different things. But the truth is that America has never been a country only for white people. And assimilation has never truly given belonging to people of color. You know, I learned how to speak English. I got a college education. I became successful. I paid taxes. I did all of those things. And yet I still encountered racist people who would tell me to go back to where I came from. You know, in fancy restaurants, people would ask me to bring them water because they thought I was the server. At my old job, a client would ask me to bring them coffee because they thought I was the assistant. And so I could assimilate as much as I want to, but I never actually became part of that melting pot. And I think this melting pot is in many ways a myth that I try to dismantle in this book.
Well, the book is called You Sound Like a White Girl, The Case for Rejecting Assimilation. It certainly has resonated with a lot of people. I want to thank you for coming in. Julissa Natseli Arce Raya, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, replanting and regrowing the things that once were here to not only pay homage, but to also preserve and even sustain. It's called rewilding, and they're doing it in some neighborhoods. You're going to hear about it tomorrow right here on GLA. You can also check us out anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Get any episode of this show at your fingertips. While you're there, subscribe to the podcast, too. Tell us what you're thinking. Give us some ideas, too. kcrw.com/GLA or kcrw.com/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Rebecca Ludman, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis-Reguarna, Michael Stark, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all gathered to put this evening's episode together. My name is Sotiris Georgios Hiotakis. Have a great night.